Just to tell you that, in fact, you can, starting from the equation that we derived, the equation on top there, if you, for example, as I was writing at some point on the blackboard, just restrict to the H plus polarization, and you want to describe how psi vary in time, supposing that X naught and Y naught are the initial unperturbed values, you can find that if only the plus polarization is present, delta X as a function of time and delta Y as a function of time, if X and Y are the two that describe the two axes here, they vary in the following way. You see, there is this minus sign here that, in fact, makes the squeezing and scratching in the two directions. And if only the cross polarization is present instead of the plus, you start from something here that will have 1 and 1 and 0 and 0, and you get that x and y are going to vary in time in this way, where here you have y and here you have x. And so it's by doing this that you find that plot there. Okay? So now I have to continue a moment with a few slides. So then I was telling you here that if you now consider a laser interferometer, which is made of the two arm cavity there, there is some laser light here that goes to the beam splitter. Half of the light it's sent on one cavity and the other on the other one, and then they recombine at the beam splitter. If a gravitational waves arrive in the direction, for example, perpendicular to where the interferometer is, you have the same effect I was explaining you in the previous slide. In the sense that these mirrors that are suspended by high and they have a typical frequency of 1 Hz, while the gravitational wave frequency that we hope to detect with this interferometer ranges between 40 Hz and 1 kHz, so it's much larger than 1 Hz. So in that sense, you can consider that these mirrors are free of moving with respect to the gravitational wave. So with this interferometer, what you monitor is the variation in the phase of light when it recombines there to the beam splitter, and in particular, you have this delta L is the difference between the length of the two arm cavities, okay, which varies in time, and delta L over L is going to be proportional to H. It's a dimensionless quantity, this one. This is called the strain, gravitational wave strain. And as we will see in a moment when we will discuss some kind of order of magnitude, typical H are of the order of 10 to the minus 21, so pretty small, tiny. And if you want to measure a delta L which is as large as possible, you want to make L as large as possible. L is the cavity, the Fabry-Perot cavity length. And so today, for example, the interferometer that have been built have an L of 4 km. Actually, this 4 km can be also increased because that is a Fabry-Perot cavity, so the light bounces back and forth many times. And by doing that, you can, if you take an H of 10 to the minus 21, as I wrote there, you get that you monitor delta L of the order of 10 to the minus 16 centimeters. So a pretty small number, and which would correspond to phase variations, delta phi, of 10 to the minus 8 radians. This seems incredible numbers, but in fact, this detector has been built. Let me tell you first that, sorry. First, we expect gravitational waves in a very large frequency band. At very low frequency of the order of 10 to the minus 16 or 10 to the minus 17 Hz, there could be gravitational waves that, for example, with future experiment, CMB experiment, could be detected through the polarization. around 10 to the minus 8 Hertz, you could detect gravitational waves with millisecond pulsars, pulsar timing. We will come back to this later. These are pulsars are just highly magnetized neutron stars, okay, that can be used as a kind of atomic clocks. And if there is some gravitational wave that passes through the pulsar and the Earth, it changes the time of arrival of the pulses from the pulsar. And from that, you can put some constraints, some bounds, or you can even detect the gravitational wave. But we will come back to this later. If you increase the frequency, hopefully there will be in the future an experiment, an interferometer in space called LISA. But I want to focus first on these last two figures. The one on the top is a first gravitational wave detector, was a resonant mass detector, was built, in fact, at Maryland by Joe Weber. And today we have, as I said, laser interferometers, LIGO, Virgo, and others. A resonant mass detector is just a, I mean, it's a bar, okay, which can put on oscillation if a gravitational wave arrives, because it can excite the mode of oscillation of the bar, which then are so the mechanical mode of oscillation through a kind of transducer can be transformed in some electrical signal, okay, that could be detected. So these were the first detectors of gravitational waves ever built. And for several years, they've been, in fact, improved in various places on the world, as you see here, in Europe, at CERN, in even Brazil, Belgium, etc. But during the last 6 years, because they allow a much larger frequency band, so you can see more sources, all the attention has been to build laser interferometers. So, in fact, these are the two LIGO interferometers. One is in the state of Louisiana, as you see the picture on the right. They are sensitive to frequency between 10 Hertz and 1 kilohertz. And the one on the left is the LIGO detector at Hanford in the state of Washington. Actually, there are two detectors here, one of 4 kilometers and one on 2 kilometers, one on top of the other. And they've been working, operating at design sensitivity for a few years, and we are collecting data and analyzing the data. There is also a French-Italian collaboration called Virgo, which is an interferometer in Italy, close to Pisa, and this GEO 600, 600 stands for 600 meter. It's a shorter interferometer. It's a UK German collaboration, and is close to Hannover. And you see also there the two arms. I don't have the picture, unfortunately, of the one in Japan, which was the first one built, 300 meter interferometer in Tokyo. You can imagine that. You have to monitor many sources of noise in order to dig out a gravitational wave, because there are so many sources of noise that can mimic a gravitational wave. Thermal noise of the mirrors, of the suspensions, seismic noise, etc. But even in Tokyo, which is not a very, I mean, it's quite active, I mean, there is a lot of seismic activity, I would say. They could build an interferometer. It was actually quite inside the city and has worked for several years. But then in Japan, they are now pushing for an upgrade of the experiment for the future. So this experiment is not working anymore. Just one plot to show you the fact that this interferometer has been working at different sensitivity. This plot on the left is what we call the equivalent strength noise. It's a unit of Hertz to the minus 1/2. So what is plotted there is what we call SH, which has the unit of Hertz to the minus 1. And when you multiply by the bandwidth of the detector and you take the square root, this is basically the delta L over L VH. And so you can read, in fact, the numbers there, 10 to the minus 21, 10 to the minus 22. And the dashed line was the design sensitivity line that was proposed at the beginning when these experiments were proposed. And the three lines there, the red, the blue, and the green, is the sensitivity that the three detectors LIGOs, three because I said in one facility there are two detectors, a 2 kilometer and a 4 kilometer, have reached. And you can see that the 4 kilometer one, for which the, you see the design sensitivity line, which is the dashed line, have reached design sensitivity, in fact, and they've been operating for several years now. This is the so-called S5 run, in fact. And on the right, just to give you an example, but we are going to discuss this much more in details, for a typical source, it's a binary system made of two neutron stars, for example, with a mass of 1.4, 1.4 solar masses. And the plot on the right gives you the exposure, so the days per megaparsec. And the blue curve corresponds to the 2 kilometer interferometer. And you see that was typically sensitive to an horizon range, which is the maximum distance the interferometer can see, of the order of 15, let's say, megaparsec. And with the 4 kilometer interferometer, the green and the red, you can go up to 30 megaparsec. For a neutron star. So these are typical numbers, and these are the numbers that will allow you to get values of age of the order of 10 to the minus 21, which are the typical numbers for a source, so for a binary, for example. Finally, one word on the experiment for the future, which is sensitive to a different frequency band, 10 to the minus 4 Hz, up to 0.1 Hz. And in fact, it's going to see different kind of sources, as we are going to learn in the following. And so this is an interferometer. Maybe you don't see very well, but there is the sun there, the Earth. And then there are three satellites that form a triangle there. And these satellites send laser light back and forth between them. And by, again, monitoring the variation of the frequency of the light, you can also measure the presence of a gravitational wave. And that triangle configuration also go around the sun as the Earth goes around the sun, okay? And this is hopefully a mission in the next maybe 10 years or even more. We don't know at the moment. Okay, any question on this part?
Do they work in a big array, some of them, just to detect like one event, so in the same time?
Yeah, so the detector, actually it's more a network, and the detectors work, so because as I was saying before, you have a lot of noise and glitches inside you know, the detector that can mimic a gravitational wave. It's very important to do a coincidence between two detectors. So by taking into account the time of flight between one detector and the other, you can, you know, basically impose that if you saw an event in one detector, for example, in Louisiana, then you have to see it also at a second time in the one of Hanford. And the same thing is done with the interferometer in Italy, the Virgo one or the Geo one. Yes, so there is, it's more a network, in fact. It's very important because otherwise it's very difficult to conclude that you measure a gravitational wave and not some transient noise in your detector. Okay. Okay, so what I want to discuss now first is I want to introduce the effective energy momentum tensor. And here I also and describe what I was anticipating before, which is how you can separate, in fact, or how you can conclude that you have a gravitational wave when you write the metric. Let me see. So first of all, instead of now introducing H mu as a perturbation with respect to the flat space time, I want to be more generic, and here I want to write, I want to assume that my metric is also curved, it's not just the one of the flat space time. And of course, I still need the fact that G mu nu, but I will need another criterion here. So there are, in fact, two possibilities. Actually, instead of putting a B, sorry, let's put a bar for the background metric. So we need to introduce a criterion to decide what is the background and what is the perturbation. And two possibilities are the following. Suppose that G bar mu has typical scale LD, and H mu mu has a typical wavelength lambda gravitational wave. So a natural criterion is that you say that the wavelength of the gravitational wave is much smaller than the typical scale LB of your background. So in this case, you can, in fact, think that if this is the how the background varies, okay, what you are saying here is that the wavelength of the gravitational wave is much smaller, and so you can think of the gravitational wave just as a ripple in your background, even if your background is not flat. Okay? Of course, I mean, something like this will be happening when once you generate a gravitational wave from a certain source. Suppose that you have like a binary system which is going around each other emitting gravitational waves, or when the two bodies merge and form a black hole. It's only when the wave is very far from your source that, even if the background is not flat, you can do this kind of reasoning. You cannot talk about gravitational waves where, you know, they are generated, because there you can talk about instantaneous potential, like Newtonian kind of potentials, but you cannot separate the wave from the background. But you can do it far from the source, for example, or a certain distance from the source. And the second possibility in which you can distinguish the wave from the background is when you say, for example, G bar mu mu as frequencies up to a certain frequency FB, and H mu mu is different from zero around F, and you say that F is much larger than FB. In this case, you can consider your background as static. So this is another possibility, another criterion that you can have. In any case, in general, when now you want to take the Einstein equation and develop them in powers of H, you don't have only H, in fact. You have two parameters. So one parameter is H, and the other one will be, for example, if you use the criterion of the wavelength, will be lambda gravitational wave divided by LB. Or if you want, it could be FB divided by F, if you use the other criterion. So you have two parameters in this expansion that you want to do. Okay, so how you can define an effective energy momentum tensor for the gravitational wave? Let me go into this part of the blackboard. So if you remember from the Einstein equation, you have the Riemann tensor, and you have the Ricci tensor here. And you can write the Ricci tensor in the following way. We write and then explain what are the different terms here. So suppose that now I want to do an expansion which is not actually just linear in H, but I want to keep track also of them quadratic in H, and I don't want to assume that my background is flat. So I can write that R mu nu is the R bar mu nu, which means the R mu nu computed on the background matrix. Okay, this is R bar mu nu. And this one here means these are the part of the R mu nu that are linear in H. And because they are linear in H, and I'm assuming, for example, let's follow the criterion one, this is going to be high frequency part. And this is going to be low frequency, because it's computed on the background, which is going to be not varying a lot. And the two here means that these are terms that can be quadratic in H. And so because they are quadratic, you could have a mixture of low plus high frequency part. Okay? For this part here. Okay, so now if I use the Einstein equation, well, first of all, I can bring this on the other side in this equation, and I can write that R bar mu nu is equal to, if I take only the low frequency part of all this, I can write minus R2 mu nu, the low frequency part, plus when there is another form in which you can write the Einstein equation, which is the following: R mu nu equal to A pi G over C to the 4 T mu nu minus 1 half G mu nu T. You might be familiar also with this other way of writing the Einstein equation. And so here, instead of R mu nu, I take 8 pi G over C to the 4. And then, because I'm taking only the low frequency part, I write this and I take the low frequency part. Okay? Okay. So now I want to introduce a scale L, which is going to be much smaller than the typical scale of the background LB and much larger than the gravitational wave. Yes?
I'm just confusing what's the difference between frequency limit and that kind of wavelength limit. You know, you have a two small parameters, you said. Yeah, I cannot see any difference between those. Probably they are related to each other by a dispersion relation.
Yeah, they could be related to each other, okay. But you could imagine a background which has, I would say, that it doesn't satisfy the condition that the scale LB, the scale LB of the background could be of the order of lambda, but the gravitation, it could be a static background, but not very homogeneous. Because the difference between the two criteria is that in one case you're assuming that this background is static in some sense, and in the other case you assume that it's almost,
Okay.
I think there is some difference between the two. I mean, you can make the same thing, in fact, but I think you could have a background which is static, and so you have, the gravitational wave is different from zero only the frequency at a certain f, but it doesn't satisfy criterion one.
I mean, just
because LB could be not of the same order, could be not much larger than lambda gravitational wave.
Yeah, I understand that the background part is not much like a wave.
Yeah.
For the background part, for the
yeah, for the gravitational wave, part, you yeah. can use the special
condition. Condition, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And they are related.
So. Yes, of course, they are related like a wave. Like a typical wave. So the frequency is the inverse of the wave. Okay.
And again, the kind of high frequency and low frequency mode means.
So now I'm using just the first criterion, okay? And I'm saying that I introduce a length here because I want to take an average. I have to take an average of this equation here. And I want to average on a volume, which is given by this L cube, where L is between the gravitational wave length and the LV. Okay?
Yeah.
Okay? So then if I take, and I want to take an average of this equation here, basically. And what I found is that if you now define little t mu nu equal to minus c to the 4 over 8 pi g, and with this symbol I mean the average of r2 mu nu minus 1 r g bar mu nu r2 average. Average over a volume with that length L, little L. Okay? Let me define this in this way. I can I derive the following equation, R bar mu mu minus 1 R some step here. So first of all, you take an average of this equation I wrote here, okay, on the top there. So you take an average of it. Of course, the average of the first term is just R bar mu nu because it's already a low frequency price computed on the background. And then by rewriting, introducing this piece here, which is in the Einstein equation, in fact, and defining the T mu nu in this way, you arrive to this equation here. So basically, this equation tells you that here you have like the Einstein equation, but computing on the metric R bar, G bar, mu nu, okay? And here on the right hand side, you have the energy momentum tensor of the matter computed on the background metric, plus this little t mu nu here that you interpret as the is quadratic in H and is going to be the energy moment, the effective energy momentum tensor associated to the gravitational wave. Okay, which is quadratic in H. And now the interesting thing is that if you are far from the source and you compute this, okay, using what we did today this morning, you can express this in terms of H mu nu, and you find that this is C to the 4 divided by A pi G, and then this is the average of D mu H alpha beta. D nu H alpha beta. Mm. So it's very simple expressed in terms of H. Okay? And in fact, in particular, if you are in the if you are in the transverse traceless gauge, this object, which is the effective energy momentum tensor associated to the gravitational wave, is just actually, if you take the zero zero component, it's h dot. H plus dot square plus H cross dot square. Okay? And this will be the T00 component.
Excuse me?
Yes.
For the definition of T mu mu, the equation you write, how can I know there is mixed of low and high frequency?
Well, because in general, I mean, the linear part.
From this example, how do I know there is a mixing?
Oh no, but when you take the average, the only thing that is going to survive is going to be the low frequency part. Because all the high frequency parts are going to be zero when you take the average. You see? So it's true that the R2, because it contains. Oh, because it contains quadratic terms, it makes you can have every time you can have, you end up having the low and high frequency. But I take the average because I want to take only the low frequency part. The high frequency is going to be average to zero. Okay, so if you have now the T00 component, you can also compute the energy flux per unit area, for example, V over dT dA. And this is going to be C cubed divided by 16 pi G and H dot square plus H dot square, this quantity here. And in fact, just to give you an idea of the numbers that come out, one typical source that can produce a gravitational wave is a supernova. So this is a collapse of a star that then forms either a neutron star to form or a black hole. And I just wanted to give you some order of magnitude comparing also with other kind of radiation that you can get from a supernova. For example, if you have a supernova at 20 kiloparsec, and you use just this formula here, and you put the typical values of H, this is the dimensionless H, by the way, that we have been using, that I used it before, okay, the 10 to the minus 21. You can, because you have to take one derivative square, that's the reason why there is an F square. You see, it goes like F square, which I normalize to 1 kHz, because when you have a collapse of a supernova, of a star that then produces the supernova explosion, the typical time scales involved are milliseconds. And so the typical gravitational wave for this kind of very violent events is of the kilohertz. So I divide by 1 kHz. And I also normalize H to this number, 10 to the minus 21. And so the process lasts just for a few milliseconds, and you get 400 ergs per centimeter squared per second. And if you want to compare with other kind of radiation, for example, from a supernova, you get also a neutrino emission, which has a very different time scale. It can last up to 10 seconds, and you have 10 to the 5 ergs per centimeter squared per second. And you also get from a supernova an optical radiation, and in that case, it's 10 to the minus 4, and it can last for a week. What is interesting is that if you really can see the supernova explosion optically, and maybe also with neutrino and with gravitational wave, you can do coincidence between these three. And so this is another way of being sure that what you detected, for example, with the laser interferometers is a gravitational wave, because you have another way of checking through the optical radiation and the neutrino.
How does it determine the direction of the object that is waveless?
Yes, so the detector, because as we will see, the gravitational wave is emitted in all directions, it's not very directional. But if you have more than one detector, you can do kind of triangulation to know from the time of arrival where it was in the sky. But you need three detectors at least, because two of them will give you only a circle in the sky. So you need another one. And this is why, for example, the detector in Europe is important for the one in the US. The two of them cannot give you the position in the sky. Okay? Yes?
Can you say something about the
LV? What is, sorry?
LV, right LV.
Oh, LV here, it's, if you, yes, so here you really, from the supernova, from supernova to the Earth at 20 kiloparsec, you can assume that the space-time is flat, I would say. So you cannot take that into account, it's not important here, it's infinity, basically. Let me see a moment. Yes, so now what I wanted to discuss, but maybe first I want to give you some order of magnitude more before entering into details and deriving this formula. You can do the same thing you do in electromagnetic theory, where if you want to study the wave generation of an electromagnetic wave from a source, from some charged particle that are accelerated and create an electromagnetic field, what you do is you do a multiple expansion. And the same thing that you can do in gravity, in general relativity. And as we discussed this morning, that linear order and linear gravity is really very similar to electrodynamics. So there are a lot of similarities that you can use, in fact, and to understand better. And first of all, H, linear order means here that H is going to be linear in G, in the Newton constant. It's going to vary as 1 over R, the distance to the source. Okay? And then you start having the different multiples. I naught, I1 will be the dipole, I2 the quadrupole, J1 the, so that is the mass quadrupole, the current quadrupole, and so on and so forth. As we will see, the first non-trivial multiple moment that produces a gravitational wave is actually the quadrupole. Very naively, you can understand this in a very naive way in linear gravity using the following argument. In electromagnetic theory, you know that the luminosity in gravitation in electromagnetic the electromagnetic luminosity goes like the dipole second time derivative of the dipole square. And the dipole, the electric dipole moment is just written there, Ex, okay, is the charge. Now, in gravitational wave theory, the electric dipole moment is the mass dipole moment. So you can write D like the sum over the mass of your source, xi. Then you take one time derivative, and you get the momentum. Now, in linear gravity, you don't have, the momentum of the source is conserved because you don't have the back action of the gravitational wave on the system. And so, basically, because of the conservation of momentum, there is no mass dipole radiation, okay? And the same thing you can do for the magnetic dipole moment, and because of the conservation of the angular momentum, so the first non-trivial multiple moment that produces a gravitational wave is the quadrupole, which I wrote there. The second prime derivative of the quadrupole, okay? And then you have the g over c to the fourth r that makes that h dimensionless. So this is why you need these powers of g and c. And 1 over r is because that is the radiative field, so it has to go like 1 over r. Now, let's compute, just to get some numbers, what is the typical order of magnitude that you get from a quadrupole variation? Well, the quadrupole is the mass multiplied by the typical length of the source, which could, I denoted there with an L, okay? L square. M L square is a quadrupole. Now, you take two time derivatives, and so suppose that the source is varying periodically with a certain period p, and so you get m l squared divided by p squared, which I wrote there, okay? And m l squared divided by p squared is like m v squared, it's a kinetic energy. And so you can rewrite this equation like g kinetic energy divided by c squared, and then c squared r. Now, if you assume that the energy which is converted in gravitational waves is, for example, corresponds to one solar mass, depending on r, the distance at which, for example, the detector can detect something, you get immediately numbers of this order of magnitude. So you see, independently on the source, if you want, could be a supernova, it could be a binary system, etc., these very tiny numbers come out because when you plug the numbers of this amount and the distance at which you are going to see this object, then you get typical numbers of this value. Okay? Are there any questions? Okay. So let's see all this in a little bit more detail. So how do you get, in fact, the quadrupole formula? Because this is very similar, in fact, to what, as I said, you do in electromagnetic theory. So this morning, we obtain this equation. Actually, I was working with h bar everywhere, yes. And by the way, this equation also implies that the t nu, the derivative, the energy momentum tensor is conserved just using the normal derivative there because we are in linearized gravity here. So you can use that. Now, in the lecture this morning, we were investigating this equation by putting t mu nu to zero because we were far from the source. But now I want to keep this term there because I want to compute how h depends, is related to the t mu nu. And this morning also we saw that starting from this equation, which has 10, these are 10 equations, if you take into account that h bar mu nu and t mu nu are symmetric, with fourth constraint, we reduce it to 6, and then you remember from this 6 we reduce to 2. This is what we did this morning. Okay, so how do we solve this equation? Well, we have to introduce a retarded Green function, as you do in electromagnetic theory. And so you will have, in fact, a Green function gx minus x prime, which is going to be minus 1 over 4 pi, 1 over x minus x prime delta. Of t minus x prime over c minus t prime. And so suppose that here you have your source and x prime is vector here and you are very far here in x, which is r the vector n, and this distance here is just x minus x prime. And I indicate with V the typical dimension of the source. So if you use the Green function that I wrote in the, there, you can write that the h bar mu is going to be 4g over c to the 4, then the integral of d3 x prime, 1 minus x prime, and then you have the t mu nu, and you have to compute it at t minus x prime over c x prime. So you have to do this integral here. And well, this is what you generally do in electromagnetic theory when you are quite far from the source. And actually, you also assume that the velocity, the typical velocity of the source, are small with respect to the speed of light. Yeah. And what you find is that you have to do the following. You have to do an expansion. So you assume that x minus x prime is going to be r minus x prime dot n plus order v squared over r. And so if you do this approximation here, you can pull this x minus x prime outside, replacing it just by r. And so what you find is that also I need to do another step, which is so this is h bar mu mu. But in order to get the transverse trace as part of it that we have to do, you have to do a projection. And you have to apply a projection such that you extract only the transverse trace as part. And I'm going to denote this projection like, so since at the end what I'm interested in is the transverse trace as part ij, I'm going to write it in the following way. I have 1 over r that comes from pulling out the x minus x prime in that integral there. And then you have 4g over c to the 4. And let me call the projection this lambda ijkl. Doesn't matter what it is for the moment. I can write it there, but it's just a projection that gives me the transverse traceless part, OK? And so then I have the integral in d3x prime on the source, which is smaller than d, of the energy momentum tensor. OK? Okay, so now the next step, which again you can follow in my notes, but I'm not going to, to do it in detail here, is that you can write this TKL here in Fourier components, because you are assuming here that your source, that the various particles, for example, that make your source, or the two black holes that make the binary, are moving in a periodic way with a certain frequency. So you can decompose this, for example, in Fourier modes, okay, this TKL. And then you use again this expansion here. And you use also the fact that if I denote by omega s the typical frequency of motion of the source, you have that omega s over c d is much smaller than 1 if you are in the slow motion approximation. Okay? What you find the final expression will be the following. So do we have an expansion in C? So you have 1 over R, 4G over C to the 4th, and then you have this projector, which is not so important here. So the first term is going to be just TKL computed in X and T. Here. And then you have an expansion in C. You have plus 1 over C, for example, if n is the vector in the direction of the gravitational wave. Then you have, for example, the derivative with respect to time of the integral of this object, dx, tkl, xn. OK? Plus order 1 over c squared. Because you are expanding, as I said, you do an expansion, okay, and so you pull out in this way all higher order terms that are going to go like 1 over c, 1 over c, 1 over c squared, etc. And here you have derivative of this while you have xn here, while here you have only the integral of tkl. Okay? In fact, in this expansion here, I'm again assuming that the source, okay, is moving at a speed v over c, which is much smaller than 1, which corresponds also to a gravitational wave that you are observing that is very far, that has a wavelength which is much larger than the typical dimension of the source v. Now, from this equation here, if you use the fact that there is the conservation of the energy momentum tensor, okay, you can actually re-express just the leading order term in the following way. Let me write it here, which gives you, in fact, the quadruple. So this term here, just the leading order term, is going to be 2g, the second time derivative of the quadruple, computing t minus r over c, where this qij is just the integral of the energy density xij minus 1/3 delta j x squared of the quadruple. So to basically reach this result here, you have to use the conservation law to express that integral of tkl in the second time derivative of an integral of the t 0, 0, and then you have xi, xj, which is what I wrote in here. So you have to do some math to arrive to this result. But this is going to be the leading order term, which scales like g c to the 4th and is proportional to the second time derivative of the quadruple. Okay? Well, once you know hij, I wrote on the blackboard before the energy emitted, the power emitted, which was proportional to h dot squared. Okay, so from that you can imagine that the power radiated, which is very important as we will see, the power radiated is going to be, so if you want d over dt d omega, it's going to be g over 8 pi c to the 5, and then it's going to be proportional, you have a q triple dot square. Okay? And so why this is important? So before I conclude, in fact, today, I want to show you one important. So this is the energy. The power radiated is the energy that is going to be emitted by the source because carried away by the gravitational wave, but it's also the energy that the system is going to lose because of the emission of gravitational waves. So this was very important because we have, in fact, an indirect proof of the existence of gravitational waves from this binary system. And in particular, the first time this was discovered was in 1974. It's called the Hals-Taylor binary. So why this is a proof of the indirect proof of the existence of gravitational waves? So I was telling you this morning that just before, that there are what we call millisecond pulsars, which are highly magnetized neutron stars. Because they are highly magnetized and there are charged particles in the magnetosphere, these particles are accelerated and they produce a beam of radiation in the direction of the pole, of the magnetic poles of the stars. And this is like a lighthouse in the sky. Each time this beam encounters the line of sight, encounters the Earth, you see a pulse. Okay. So you have like, as I said, you have this is a neutron star, you have the magnetic field, and it emits a radiation. It's like a beam of radiation. And when the beam encounters the Earth, you see a pulse. And the neutron star is rotating, okay? And so you observe these pulses. And the period of these pulses is incredibly stable. These are like atomic clocks, okay? And this was these pulses were discovered in the 60s. However, in 74, the first pulsar in a binary system was discovered. And the way in which they discovered it was because if you don't have an isolated pulsar, but is part of a binary system, it moves. No? The two objects, the two neutron stars that form the binary, move with respect to each other. And so you have a variation in the time of arrival of these pulses due to the fact that the pulsar is not fixed in space somewhere, but is moving relative to the other. And the variation of the time of arrival of these pulses also depend on the orbital frequency, the orbital period of the binary. And the orbital period is varying in time because of the emission of gravitational waves, because the gravitational wave carry away energy from the system. So the system is losing energy, and so it's shrinking time. And so by observing, measuring the variation in time of these pulses, and by comparing with the prediction of general relativity due to the fact that this should be due to the emission of gravitational waves, people found an incredible agreement. And let me show you, in fact, what was found. So this binary has one pulsar, 59 milliseconds, is rotating. And the period of the two of the binary system is 8 hours, compared with 1 year, you know, the period of the Earth around the Sun. They go very fastly, you can imagine. They are separated by 1 million of kilometers. The mass of the two objects in the binary is around 1.4, which is the typical mass for a neutron star. And the eccentricity is not so small, it's 0.6. Okay? Now, what you can measure here is the following. To show agreement, what they did, they compared the observed orbital phase with a theoretical template phase. What I mean for that is that, suppose that there is no emission of gravitational waves, the phase, the orbital phase phi b, is going to be just 2 pi the frequency multiplied by time. So the blue part is zero, because the blue part is just a Taylor expansion of the frequency. And so f dot there means that the frequency is varying in time. The only way in which the frequency can vary in time is because the system is emitting gravitational waves. If you are in Newtonian gravity, no, the two bodies are going to be there in that orbit forever. Correct? So if you do a Taylor expansion, you get the blue part there. Okay. Now, if you assume that TP is the periastron passage time, which is defined as when the phase is equal to 2 pi n, you find this equation. And then you pull this on the other side there, and you get TP minus this equal to this. So if you have a theory that tells you how the frequency varies as a function of time, and this we are going to compute it tomorrow, in fact, how this frequency varies in time, you can test this formula. And this is what this plot on the left is telling you. This plot is exactly the cumulative shift of periastron time, is basically this quantity here, as a function of time. The time is from the discovery of the pulsar, of the binary pulsar, up to 2000. And that's the curve. The dots are the measure point, the one observed. And the line is the prediction from general relativity. And in fact, the prediction, it's good at the level of 0.5%. So it's a very good indication that, that general relativity is correct, which means also in this particular case that the system is losing energy because of the emission of gravitational waves. So this is why we see that plot there. And so it's an indirect proof that gravitational wave exists. And just one word, forget for this plot on the right. This is quite interesting. This was the first binary pulsar that was ever discovered. But since then, in 74, something like other maybe 6, 7 binary pulsars have been discovered. And just a few years ago, a so-called double pulsar binary has been discovered. In this case, you don't have only one pulsar in the binary, but both of them are pulsar. So you see these pulses from both the bodies, the two bodies in the system. And what is very exciting of this is also that it's much more relativistic, because the orbital period is around 2 hours and 45 minutes. And they are quite close at a distance of 0.6 kiloparsec, so this binary. So you might wonder, can we see this binary for, you know, in the gravitational wave detector? Because this binary is very close, it's 0.6 kiloparsec. It's there. It's emitting gravitational waves, we think, because we can explain the variation of the pulses through it. Well, the problem is that if you compute the frequency of gravitational waves at that period, 2 hours and 45 minutes, this frequency is around 10 to the minus 4 Hertz, which is where LISA will be, maybe in 2020. But it's actually marginally visible by LISA. In fact, as a signal-to-noise ratio, we'll have of something like one or a few, OK? That is not in the bandwidth of the LIGO detectors. It will be in the bandwidth of the LIGO detector only when the period is going to be much smaller. So when the two bodies are going to be very, very close to each other, close to merger. But if you see there, they will merge in 85 million years. So this is not a source that can be seen by LIGO. But there are many binaries that we don't observe, you know, through these pulses that we think exist, that are close to merger. And these will be the sources that LIGO, we hope, is going to see. OK? But not this one. But this proves that they exist, at least, these binary systems. OK, I think I stop here. And are there questions about what we discussed?
Sorry.
Yes.
Is the frequency of LISA?
Sorry?
I mean, is the frequency of this in the ring of LISA?
Yeah, it's actually, so the frequency of the gravitational wave for this source here, it's around 10 to the minus 4 Hertz. So it's in the best, in the, at the beginning of the bandwidth of LISA, in fact, because the best the sensitivity of LISA is 10 to the minus 3. So it's there. So so we have to wait some, well, maybe for, I hope that at the time we can see it with LISA, we have already seen it, something else in LIGO. Otherwise, we have to wait a long, long time. OK.
Thank you.
OK.